This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
This podcast episode is a recording of the 2025 Royal Historical Society lecture at the German Historical Institute London, given by Roland Wenzelhümer, Professor for Modern History at the University of Munich, and one of the directors of the Käthe Hamburger Research Center, Global Disconnect, on Raise, Reuse, Recycle, Global History and Marine Salvage in the 19th and Early 20th Century. Oceans and seas have long been a focal point in historiography, particularly in the field of global history, which emphasizes the connective power of these vast bodies of water. This focus naturally extends to the study of seafaring, shipbuilding, and maritime infrastructures. Yet while global history highlights oceanic linkages, it has also acknowledged the inherent dangers and uncertainties of seafaring, from the so-called Age of Exploration through to the 20th century. Shipwrecks, ranging from minor groundings to catastrophic maritime disasters, have always played a central role in maritime history. Historians of this field have recognized the disruptive effects of these wrecks and have examined the development of maritime security and insurance systems designed to mitigate risks, safeguarding both passengers and investors alike. But what of the wrecked ship itself, its lost cargo, and the tragic fate of its crew? What about the environmental or navigational hazards posed by the wrecks? And what of the symbolic weight that many sunken ships carry? This talk turns the spotlight on marine salvage and its significance in global history. Salvage operations, as ancient as seafaring itself, primarily aim to recover valuable resources or clear hazardous wreckage. At times, they also seek to uncover the causes of maritime accidents or to retrieve vessels of particular symbolic importance. In any case, salvage work is a complex endeavor, fraught with nautical, technical, environmental, and legal challenges. And studying this practice offers valuable insights into the intricate dynamics of global connections and disconnections, insights this talk aims to explore.
Thank you so much, Lucy. Thank you so much, Frau von Hodenberg. It's my great privilege to stand in front of you tonight and deliver this year's Royal Historical Society lecture on global history at the German Historical Institute in London. A privilege, let me assure you, that I deeply honor, and at the same time, no small challenge. Because in front of this audience, what can I say about the field of global history that you do not already know, or even worse, that many of you can say many times better than me? Contemplating this precise question when preparing for the talk, I began to fear that tonight I can only fail in this regard and disappoint. However, as I was preparing this on rather short notice, it was way too late to run, and I was never a great runner anyway, so I decided to face the situation and go all in, and then it happened and I got a little carried away, because I decided to talk about something or to choose a subject that I have only recently started to work on and where again chances are that many of you will know more about it than I do. I'm talking about the history of marine salvage and its role in global history. So what I will do in the following, I will try to introduce this subject all the way trying to conceal that in many aspects I'm standing at the very beginning, both empirically as well as conceptually. So if that's the case, you absolutely rightly ask yourself, why then this topic at this particular point in time for this lecture? Because I think the history of salvage is both a worthwhile and a largely overlooked subject of study, and it has a lot to tell us. I claim it is awash, as you will hear in a second, with fascinating and instructive stories. Most importantly, however, I think that it has something to tell us about the future and also offer us for the future of global history as such. Let's start with a photograph that seems to come from a different age, although it has been only 16 years since. Tempting as it would be, especially tonight, we are less interested in the gentleman behind the desk or in his office. Tonight it's all about his furniture, in particular about the desk that features so prominently in this picture, or in this one. This is the so-called Resolute desk. Since the late 19th century, the main desk in the White House's Oval Office. In the course of the post-war White House reconstruction, the desk was moved to the so-called broadcast room and used as a prop for presidential addresses. Under John F. Kennedy, the desk came back to the Oval Office and was later part of a traveling exhibition in memory of the assassinated president. During Jimmy Carter's presidency, the desk then returned to the Oval Office and remains there until the present day. Well, who knows, you know? It features in presidential addresses, in countless photographs and documentaries, as well as in popular fiction, from novels to Hollywood movies. While the word is probably overused, in this case, I think it's fair to say that the Resolute desk is iconic, certainly in an American context, probably also in a broader Western cultural context. No matter how much recent US presidents might have wished that the desk's name reflected one of their principal qualities, the name actually goes back to a ship, HMS Resolute. The Resolute was one of several ships sent out from England in the year 1852 to search for John Franklin's lost Arctic expedition. In the course of this search, the ship was encased in floe ice in 1853. The crew abandoned the ship in spring 1854, and the ice floe, along with HMS Resolute, steadily drifted southeast for almost 1.5 years until an American whaler discovered it, still enclosed in ice, in September 1855. The crew of the whaler salvaged the vessel and sailed it back to New London, Connecticut. Eventually, the U.S. Congress purchased the Resolute, had it refitted, and sailed back to England, where it was presented to Queen Victoria as a gift and token of friendship. HMS Resolute served in the Royal Navy for another unbelievable 23 years until it was decommissioned in 1879 and salvaged for timber. From some of the oak timbers, a richly decorated partner desk was made and eventually presented to the then US President Rutherford Hayes as a return token by Queen Victoria. And this means that the White House's principal office desk is the product of a double act of salvage. First, the salvage of the adrift Resolute by the whaling crew, and then the salvage of timber by the Royal Navy, a much more standard procedure. In both cases, the original incentive behind the salvaging was probably economic, at least as far as the whalers and the Navy shipyards were concerned. But the particular history of the HMS Resolute made the ship, and later its remains, much more valuable. Its planks turned out to be more than mere oak. They were tokens of human curiosity, of daring explorations, and resource-intensive rescue events. Laden with such symbolism, they made first-rate diplomatic presents and allowed all sorts of yarn to be spun around them. And for those of you who would like to believe that this sounds like a very 19th century thing to do, let me inform you that in the year 2009, British Prime Minister Gordon Brown presented President Obama with a fitting pen holder for his desk, made from wood of HMS Gannet, a 19th century sloop of war active in anti-slavery patrols. Oceans and seas have long received quite a bit of attention in modern historiography, and rightly so. What began with a fascination of European historians for the Mediterranean soon gave us the Black and later the Red Atlantic. The Indian Ocean seascape moved into the historical limelight in the late 1990s and early 2000s, soon to be followed by a renewed interest in the Pacific world, both in its islands as well as in the waters surrounding them. And recently, as historians are increasingly scrutinizing the so-called margins, the Arctic seas fuel our historiographical imagination. Oceans and other large bodies of water have always presented formidable obstacles to human mobility, a quality that the British, for instance, have been critically aware of throughout the history of this island, and a quality, if I may say so, that current European border authorities are equally conscious of and have no qualms to exploit for their ends, regardless of the great human cost involved. Interestingly, however, modern historiography, while acknowledging the separating potential of the seas, has been much more interested in their connecting qualities. From Brodel's Mediterranean via the history of the so-called European expansion to the Age of Steam, the sea was tricky and treacherous, but in the end, it had to endure people traversing it with ever better, faster, and bigger means. Much of historiography's fascination with the sea was and is, therefore, actually a fascination with the sea surface and its being turned into a zone of human traffic and trafficking. The field of global history has been among the foremost advocates of such a perspective on the seas. It never failed to emphasize how the seas connected people and regions at the shores in various aspects, and how they thus contributed to the emergence of economically, socially, and culturally deeply interwoven regions that we then call the Mediterranean world or the Atlantic world, to give but two examples. Along with this perspective came global history's profound interest in ports, ships, seafarers, nautical knowledge and techniques, or ship crews and the passengers. That means a profound interest in all the actors, means, and ideas that have eventually turned the seas from a lake to a lane, to borrow a thought from Valeska Huber, who coined this phrase in the context of the opening of the Suez Canal and its consequences for Mediterranean shipping traffic. In short, global history has always emphasized the transregional connections in human history, and it has particularly done so in its engagement with the oceans and the seas. To be fair, however, global historians have not only told a story of the sea as the great connector, they were and they are still critical of the countless disconnects, ruptures, and failures that are part and parcel of maritime history. Maritime history is also a history of respect or even fear of the sea. It is a history of storms or of no wind at all, a history of fog and of ice, a history of the shallows, and the history of the abyss. Or, to wax a little less lyrically, maritime history is also a history of shipwreck, from smaller, almost everyday groundings to large catastrophes involving the loss of countless lives at sea. Global history has acknowledged and, to a certain degree, also studied these discomforting and disconnecting aspects of the subject. Wreckages do play a notable role in global historical research in many different ways. From the sinking of the Titanic or the Lusitania to the self-destruction of the remaining German Navy ships after the First World War, to which we will come back later in this talk, from the questionable but historically colorful practice of intentionally luring ships into shallow waters in order to plunder them, to the emergence of sophisticated ship insurance systems and maritime security regimes. Even the cultural and literary significance of shipwreck, from Shakespeare to Defoe to Jan Matthel's Life of Pi, has not gone unexamined, a fact that, among other things, gave us the idea of an outright shipwreck modernity. To summarize, the history of the sea, as well as the history of shipping, has mostly been conceived or told as a history of interdependence and connection, but of course historians have not been blind to the difficulties, technical challenges, and human disasters that are also woven into this history. The storms, shoals, accidents, sinkings, battles on the high seas, even the self-sinking of ships and their disruptive effects certainly have their place in global history, both analytically and narratively. Mostly, however, this is where historical inquiry ends, with the sunken ship and the band that plays no more. If there is a story after that, It usually unfolds on land, in courthouses, in insurance offices, in navy yards, or even in parliamentary debate. But rarely does our focus remain on the wreckage site. What of the wrecked ship itself, its lost cargo, and the tragic fate of the crew? What of the resources that make such a ship? The timber, the iron, or the steel, the equipment on board? What about the environmental or navigational hazards posed by these wrecks? And what of the symbolic weight that many sunken ships carry? When a ship sinks, runs aground, or has to be saved from some other peril, it turns into a liability for some and into a resource for others. The original technical meaning of the term salvage points to this. It refers to the payment that had to be made to a party that had saved or had helped to save a ship in distress or its crew and cargo respectively. Such payment rewarded the dangers that the savers subjected themselves to, and it was also aimed at discouraging piracy and the plundering of a ship in distress. Salvage practices and regulations go back to antiquity and have over the centuries become an established part of maritime law that follows clear principles of engagement and reward. In common parlance, however, the meaning of the word salvage has been significantly expanded. Occasionally, the term denotes the act of salvaging itself. Mostly, however, it refers to the goods or materials saved from a wrecked ship, or indeed in any situation in which such goods would otherwise perish. In the context of this talk and the broader research it builds on, I try to preserve some of the original qualities of the term and at the same time to carefully expand it. I am particularly interested in how wrecked, damaged, or simply old and obsolete ships become a new kind of resource. The original meaning of salvage is useful here, as it points to the clearly defined conditions under which this usually happens, as well as to the fact that gain and loss, opportunity and liability must be thought of in pairs. Also, for the purpose of my own research, I stay safely in the maritime and shipping realm. I am interested in ships, their crews and passengers, the materials they are built from, the cargoes they carried, and also, as you will see, in the yarns spun around them. In other aspects, however, I expand the meaning of salvage. Mostly my usage of the term refers to that which is saved from a ship, reused or recycled. For me, salvage can be both material and immaterial, or often material, charged with a strong immaterial narrative. In salvage practice, of course, much depends on the wreckage site. Ships that run aground, suffer some damage but do not sink, can be salvaged as a whole. If the situation permits, they are refloated, patched up, and then towed away, either to be repaired in a dock or to be scrapped in a breaking yard. In the course of this, they often change hands. Sometimes grounded ships are dismantled on the spot and sold for scrap. Ships that sink in relatively shallow waters and cannot be refloated can be dismantled by divers and with the help of salvage equipment whose sophistication depends a lot on the historical period that we are talking about. Underwater salvage operations usually concentrate only on the most valuable materials that make a ship, and of course on the cargo, which is often the primary object of salvage anyway. Even ships that sink on the high seas and are beyond the practical reach of material salvage operations, can turn into resources. Their fate becomes the fuel of popular stories, even myth. Some wrecks become the sites of scientific, often pseudo-scientific, exploration, or tourist playgrounds even. Artifacts from the sites become collector's items. The Titanic is probably the best known example for such immaterial salvage, but it is by far not the only one. Finally, I would also like to think of the practice of ship breaking as a form of salvage. In this case, there is no accident involved, but ships merely reach the end of their life and are sent to the breaking yard. There, equipment and fittings are dismantled and auctioned off. The ship itself is then broken up and sold for scrap. While this practice mostly lacks the spectacle and adventure associated with marine salvage operations, it shares the fact that at the breaker's yard, the ship becomes a resource and its components and materials gain a second life. The history of a ship does not end at the bottom of the sea, aground on a sandbank or in the breaker's yard. Some can be repaired, some are gutted on the spot, some are raised, others dismantled underwater. Whenever possible, valuable cargo, ship components, or the timber and iron of the ship itself are salvaged, resold, reused, or recycled. Even ships beyond the physical reach of salvage divers often find a new destiny as the stuff of myth or tourist curiosity. Through salvage, the ruptures and disconnections of maritime history become new beginnings. Salvage creates resources out of failure, often for a rather colorful set of historical actors. For wreckers and plunderers who intentionally lure ships aground, for salvage operators, some of which work in highly professional, specialized companies, and others are mere soldiers of fortune. For daredevil salvage divers and the inventors and engineers who develop the diving equipment, for scrap dealers who speculate with sunken ships, for auctioneers, tourist operators, and explorers, and recently even for Hollywood movie directors such as James Cameron. Accordingly, the study of salvage has a lot to say about the relationship between connectivity and disconnectivity, entanglement and rupture, in the context of global history. And it brings global history into direct conversation with many other worthwhile fields of historical inquiry, environmental history, the history of technology, or legal history, to name but a few. However, despite its analytical and integrative potential, there is to date very little research on the history of salvage. Most of the important studies on maritime history, particularly those that take a bird's eye perspective, mention salvage only in passing, if at all. Interestingly, many of these works do dwell on the history of maritime accident and shipwreck, but pay next to no attention to salvage. More specialized studies on the history of salvage are rare as well. There is, of course, a huge body of legal literature on salvage law. Some of these works do have a historical interest in the emergence and evolution of salvage regulations. They come from both legal scholars as well as historians, are often hugely interesting, but their focus usually remains, again, firmly on land. It rests on the lawmakers, the courts, or the insurance companies, rarely on the ships, their crews, or their cargoes. The salvage practices and the salvaged goods themselves have so far seen little research, of course, with a few notable exceptions. Finnish historian Juha Matti Krankvist, for instance, is interested in maritime salvage and marine recycling in 18th century Sweden. At that time, one firm held a salvage monopoly in Sweden and sold salvage materials and cargo in public auction. Krankvist argues that these auctions and the recycling they made possible have been very important for the Swedish shipbuilding industry in an age before industrial mass production. In his book with the title Arts of Logistics, performance studies scholar Shane Boyle takes a different perspective on salvage. He interprets salvage as a practice of loss prevention and thus as a deeply capitalist activity. He says, "Salvaging is one way that capitalism transforms loss into reward, a thought that I try to build on in this talk." Fortunately, the practice of ship breaking, that means the breaking up of a ship at the end of its life, has seen some study, although mainly with a focus on the breaking industry in late 20th century India and Bangladesh, where gigantic ships are beached and then dismantled by scores of local workers under detrimental conditions, detrimental both for the workers and the local environment. Most notable and informative in this context are Ayushi Dhawan's works on the Alang shipbreaking yard. The older industrial shipbreaking industry, for instance in late 19th century Britain, has seen very little research in comparison. Although only marginally concerned with ship salvage as such, one book that deserves special mention here is Michael Stammer's The End of Voyages, The Afterlife of a Ship from 2005. For many years, Stammer's was the keeper of Merseyside Maritime Museum in Liverpool and had excellent access to all sorts of maritime history resources. He was among the first to focus not on the history of shipbuilding or on ship voyages, but on ships' end-of-life fates. I found this shift of attention very inspiring and tried to develop it further in my work on salvage. There is some other work, of course, for instance, on wreckers or plunderers, and of course one finds quite a few anecdotal mentions of salvage. But at least to my knowledge, this about sums up the current state of research on the subject matter. Accordingly, and if you pardon the pun, there are still many treasures to be raised in this field and many lessons to be learned. However, before I say a little more on what these treasure chests might contain, I would like to share a number of examples of marine salvage in order to demonstrate the ubiquity of the practice as well as some of its main contexts. Let's start with a comparatively well-known case, HMS Royal George. The Royal George was a so-called ship of the line, a warship equipped with around 100 guns. She was launched in 1756 and at that time was the largest warship in the world. She saw service in the Seven Years' War and later in the American War of Independence. Then in 1782, she sank, anchored at Spithead off Portsmouth. HMS Royal George was getting prepared and provisioned for her next engagement, and in this context she was intentionally rolled, that means she was tipped to one side, for maintenance work. However, this was done all wrong. The ship rolled too far, caught water, and quickly sank. Although anchored in shallow waters of about 20 meters depth, around 800 people lost their lives, making the sinking of the Royal George one of the biggest maritime disasters in British waters. Many of the casualties were visitors to the ship, workmen, visiting relatives, merchants, and also prostitutes. Many were on board because the sailors were not allowed to leave the ship due to fear of desertion. There would be a lot more to say about the ignorance and incompetence that led to this totally avoidable disaster, or about how those responsible were later acquitted while the sinking was attributed to the general bad condition of the ship. However, here we are mainly interested in what happened to the wreck afterwards. First attempts at salvage started soon, both to save some of the military ordnance that HMS Royal George carried and to clear the substantial navigational hazard that her wreck had become. In the same year of her sinking, Charles Spalding recovered 15 heavy guns with the help of a diving bell. The Royal George was one of the last ships equipped with those expensive bronze guns instead of the cheaper iron guns, and that was an important incentive behind the salvage operation. After Spalding, it took almost 50 years until brothers Charles and John Dean started a second attempt at salvage in 1834. They used a diving helmet and managed to recover another 27 guns. Another 5 years later, in 1839, Charles Paisley, a British military engineer, took a new approach. Under his direction, divers used underwater charges to blow up the ship and give access to the remaining guns and cargo, and by 1842, another 30 guns had been raised and other materials recovered included surgical instruments and silkware, apparently all in good order. By 1843, the keel and other major ship timbers had also been salvaged and the site was then considered cleared. But what happened to the salvaged goods and materials? Until today, one gun is on display in the Royal Armoury's collection in Southsea Castle. Many others were melted down and used in the bronze works of Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square. Some of the salvaged timber was used to make a billiard table, and some more timber landed in the hands of one George Wombwell, a well-known menagerie owner. Wombwell, who allegedly had a way with animals, had helped Prince Albert with the handling of his dogs. When offered a return favor by Albert, Wombwell asked for timber from the Royal George and then had his future coffin made of it. having no immediate use for the coffin and being a showman through and through, Wundwell put the coffin on public display for a fee. We'll return to the coffin later. Salvage and shipbreaking remain important practices in the steam age. Actually, as ships constantly increased in size and iron and steel were used in large quantities, recycling those building materials became economically even more interesting. The famous Great Eastern can serve as a first example. Built in the 1850s after designs from Isambard Kingdom Brunel, she was for a while the largest ship in the world. Too large, apparently, to be economically employed as a passenger liner. She was soon used as a cable-laying ship, then refitted again as a passenger liner, and again with no economic success. She remained moored at Milford Harbour for many years before it was eventually decided to break her up and sell the salvage as scrap. Before this was done, in 1889 and 1890, however, most of the movable equipment, the furniture and fittings were auctioned off with great public interest. A lot of people acquired memorabilia from the famous ship, usually small things like lamps or porcelain. But there was also a buyer who had a bar of a public house built from the ship's wood paneling. And most notably, however, was one of the Great Eastern's masts was bought by Everton Football Club and put up as a flagpole in Anfield Football Stadium, where Everton FC used to reside until 1892. When Everton left Anfield, the flagpole remained and now flies the Liverbird flag on match day. The actual breaking of the Great Eastern took around 18 months. Due to the size and solid build of the ship, it was technically challenging and much, much more expensive than expected. Unlike the movable memorabilia, whose often curious further uses were documented by contemporary newspapers and other observers, it is much harder to say what exactly happened to the massive amounts of scrap metal from the ship. Most of it was certainly melted and used in the production of new steel, but at the moment I cannot say where or for which further purpose. And the same is unfortunately true for the last example I would like to share with you today. The raising of the remains of the German fleet in Scapa Flow after the First World War. Scapa Flow is a body of water sheltered between the main islands of the Orkneys. In the course of the naval arms race between Britain and Germany before the war, the British built a naval base there. And after the armistice of November 1918, the remaining ships of the German fleet were sent to Scapa Flow to be interned there as long as peace negotiations were ongoing. The ships had already been stripped of their weapons and all their instruments and had only a minimum crew on board. As the Versailles negotiations were drawing to a close, German commander Ludwig von Reuter feared that the resulting peace treaty would lead to a handover of the fleet to Britain and or its allies. To prevent this, von Reuter and his officers decided to scuttle the remaining German warships on 21st June 1919, exactly a week before the eventual signing of the Versailles peace treaty. Of 74 interned German ships, 52 sank in the shallow waters of Scapa Flow, where they became a navigational hazard that the British somehow had to take care of. In 1923, four destroyers were raised. One year later, British engineer Ernest Cox bought the remaining 26 destroyers and the two large battle cruisers, Hindenburg and Seydlitz, from the Admiralty. Cox ran a shipbreaking yard and had little business at the time. Concurrently, the price of scrap metal had been on the rise, so that salvage operations promised to be profitable. Cox started a major salvage operation in Scapa Flow. He bought a dry dock and experimented with new techniques to raise and float the large ships. He was mainly interested in the high-quality steel that the ships were made of, but there is also a story that during a coal strike, Cox had his men salvage coal from the still-submerged Seydlitz to fire the engines of the salvage machines. In the end, The salvage operation was much, much more complicated and expensive than expected. It proved economically unviable. It's a recurring pattern in a way. It is hard to say what happened to the scrap metal. Rumor has it that at least part of it was sold back to Germany, where it was allegedly used to build a new fleet. But as of now, this is an unsubstantiated claim, not backed up by any hard evidence, or at least not by any evidence that a professional historian would consider viable. Some ships could not be salvaged and remain in deeper waters up to this day. Interestingly, they became the targets of a smaller scale salvage operation after the Second World War in order to obtain so-called low background steel. Steel produced after the detonation of the two atomic bombs in 1945 and the accompanying nuclear testing has a background radiation that made it unfit for use in sensitive instruments. So-called pre-war steel, especially if it had been submerged underwater, did not have such background radiation and was therefore better suited for Geiger counters and other such appliances. It was mainly salvaged from ships wrecked before the Second World War, albeit in much smaller quantities than general scrap metal. Now, listening to me rambling on about these salvage examples, you must have asked yourselves, so what? Let's see if I can help answer this question. Before I got interested in the history of salvaging, I had never heard of low background steel and its industrial appliances. I find the story and how it connects shipwrecks and salvage to the atomic age absolutely captivating, just as captivating as many of the other stories that I quickly touched upon today, be it the Resolute Desk, Anfield's flagpole, or the coffin made out of timber from the Royal George. As you can probably tell from my talk, I harbor a deep fascination for such stories and I love to share them. They throw us deeper into history and acquaint us with its curious ways, and that, I believe, is a virtue in its own. Even more importantly, however, I believe that these stories and the history of salvage in general are of larger historical and historiographical significance. I will come to this in a minute. But before, let me try to briefly sort through what all these cases are actually about. What was the background of the salvage operations? What were the incentives, the liabilities and opportunities behind them? What happened to the salvage goods and memorabilia? And what does all of this tell us about salvage as a practice? As is obvious from these examples, there were a lot of different reasons for salvage. To save valuable cargo or instruments, to recycle building materials, to clear navigational hazards, to test new technologies, to encapsulate and thus preserve, or even to create a certain memory of the ship and its history, to investigate the reasons behind a disaster, or to safeguard the environment. In all of these cases, the ship and its goods become resources of different kinds that can then be salvaged and exploited. Often, actually in most cases, the different kinds of resources and with them the intentions of the salvagers overlap. Let's take the Royal George as an example. Its cannons were very valuable and were to be reused. At the same time, some were melted and used to build Nelson's Column, a highly symbolic act, of course, as is the construction of a coffin and the billiard table from its timbers. The wreck was also a testing ground for Charles Paisley's new diving techniques, and it was a substantial navigational hazard. Many different reasons and intentions, and accordingly, salvage is of nautical, economic, cultural, political, legal, environmental relevance, all at the same time. Among other aspects, it is this multi-layeredness that makes the subject so significant historiographically, at least in three regards. First, I think the practice of salvage can tell us a lot about the interplay between connection and rupture, rupture and connection. Second, I argue that the subject builds a lot of very interesting bridges to neighboring fields of inquiry. And third, I claim that salvage puts the spotlight on the idea of history itself. Regarding the first point, shipwreck causes rupture. That's a truism at best. Ships and the things and people they carry are central enablers of global entanglements. Wreckage interrupts these entanglements in no trivial way. cargo, passengers, money, troops, information do not arrive as expected. Wreckage means a loss of infrastructure and investment, and foremost, it means a loss of predictability and trust. Or shorter, shipwreck brings rupture to connection. Now, I claim that in many cases, salvage brings connection to rupture, by which the relationship between connection and disconnection finally comes full circle. Salvaged cargo, but also iron, steel, timber, and sometimes even coal from the wrecks, are reused, recycled, traded. At this moment, we know little about the exact amounts of salvaged materials, about their further fates and pathways, but it is reasonably safe to assume that they created new, potentially global connections. Easier to trace are the instruments, the fittings or furnitures, auctioned office memorabilia in some cases. They also traveled the globe, and with them, a lot of memories, heroic narratives, and other good yarns. Stories that turn ship planks into suitable diplomatic gifts, or wood paneling into a pub counter. Professional salvage operators are a new group of global actors trying to navigate treacherous waters just as much as the thicket of international maritime law and salvage regulations. They are joined by divers, ship surveyors, auctioneers, plunderers, insurers, spectators, who all hold a stake in salvage operations. Currently, we know too little about all these connecting aspects and actors. Which new global connections emerged from the rupture of shipwreck? How did salvage materials circulate and in which quantities? What was their economic significance? And so on and so forth. I argue that once we start to examine these and other related questions, a lot can be learned about the relationship and interplay of global connections and disconnections. Second, the history of salvage builds sustainable bridges to other fields of historical inquiry. In the light of the examples introduced today, this is hardly surprising. There are obvious connections to the history of technology, heritage studies, or legal history. Beyond those, practices of reuse and recycling become ever more important in the environmental humanities, and other conceptual overlaps exist with material history, a field with a particularly strong theoretical tradition, or with archaeology, a discipline that is today standing at the very interface between the humanities and the life sciences. Many of these fields are intellectually vibrant, very topical, or had to reinvent and reposition themselves recently. Global history can only benefit from a frequent and systematic exchange with these and other fields. Third and finally, salvage practices, particularly but not only those concerned with memorabilia and stories, directly confront us with the uses of history. Through salvage, actors intentionally surround themselves with history, sometimes metaphorically, sometimes quite literally, if we think of the coffin. Salvage consists of layers and layers of the past that actors transform into history, willingly or not. That's more than obvious with the Resolute desk, the fitting pen holder from an anti-slavery patrol ship, or the bronze guns melted into Nelson's column. Maybe less obviously, however, why is there a rumor that scrap from the scuttled German fleet might have been sold back to Germany and used to build new ships? Does it make any practical difference where the raw materials for Hitler's fleet had come from, what the steel had been part of before it was melted again? Apparently it does. And so, if we want it or not, salvage takes us to the very heart of what we historians do. The history of salvage is about the idea of history itself. At the end of this talk, let me offer a little provocation by slightly rearranging the relationship of salvage and global history. So far, this talk has been about the role of salvage in global history. What about dropping the "in" for a moment? What if at some point in time we will have to think about how to historiographically salvage global history as a field of inquiry? Sure, the ship of global history is tight and fast afloat. There are more hands on deck than ever before. While the winds might have been calming down a bit lately, the sails are still reasonably bulging. But what about the course that this ship has been sailing on over the last years? Where does it take us, global historians, but also historical inquiry as such? To new shores, as was the promise of global history from its very inception? Or are we rather steering towards the shallows, where the sandbanks and reefs of historiography are waiting for the careless, and where the ship of global history will eventually become a case for the salvagers? Or, dropping these cheesy nautical metaphors, what is the current innovative potential of global history, and what is its role in the larger context of historiography? What can global historians contribute conceptually in the coming years, especially in the context of worldwide political, societal, and environmental shifts that we are currently witnessing? Are we suitably prepared for the difficult times ahead? For a long time, global history's focus has rested firmly on questions of connectivity in all its forms and varieties, and rightly so. This has been and still is an important approach and a necessary counterweight to the imbalances of national history. But what then? Does global history's contribution begin and end with the claim that there are global connections everywhere? Currently, this is still the established narrative, and global history starts to repeat itself. In order to keep the field intellectually vibrant and rewarding, it might be helpful to readjust global history's perspective, not necessarily to reinvent it, just to slightly adjust it. And this brings me back to the topic of salvage and the broader insights we can gain from its study. My first point was that the study of salvage opens a new perspective on the mutually constitutive relationship of connections and disconnections. Maybe this can help to at least slightly break up the established entanglement narrative that is still so prevalent in global history. Second, salvage builds sustainable bridges to other fields and disciplines, many of which have gone through similar challenges and have come out alive and kicking. Cooperating with and learning from these fields, from environmental history, from archaeology, can only do us good and keep us sharp. And third, I claimed that the history of salvage is about the idea of history itself. A grandiose claim, I know, but hopefully not completely without substance. It leads us to the big questions of our field that have fallen so out of fashion in the last decades. Questions about what history actually is and why we study it, the theory and philosophy of history, subjects that global history has often been too busy to concern itself with. Please do not get me wrong, I'm not saying that the study of salvaging will innovate global history, certainly not single-handedly, maybe not at all. In the end, salvage is just one interesting subject among many, among countless. It was merely my intention to demonstrate how the history of salvage leads us to issues of much broader significance for our field, issues that we can and should take seriously and that we can employ to readjust global history's more general outlook. Other subjects provide different, maybe even more important impulses. Impulses that will help to keep the sails of global history set and in the wind. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.